C2PR. Number 15B.
So we have as an epitome those two ideas together. By uncovering, rebuking, and relinquishing error, since sickness and death are healed. Well, perhaps we would, if we would reword it today, we would perhaps put it a little bit different. We perhaps could say that by rebuking sin, error is destroyed. We could also say it would be much shorter, actually. So with this, I just want to take this example as another sideline. Namely, I think I have already indicated it, but perhaps to repeat it is good. Namely, don't think that these epitomes are the only possible rendering to bring out the tone. We can bring out the tone with other terms also, just as I have said it now. We have read the rendering that I did some, 30 years ago nearly, which said, by uncovering, rebuking, and relinquishing error, sin, sickness, and death are healed. It shows that the rebuke of soul is healing. Healing means destroying error. We perhaps today, when we were talking about it, we would have said this epitome. We could also say by reproving sin, we cast out error, or we cast out sin, sickness, and death. It could be the same tone, just other terms. So don't be more papal than the Pope. This is no paper from the Vatican, which is absolute doctrine and cannot be changed and stays for there for eternity. It is just one way of trying to symbolize, to bring out the tonality of it. So when you go over it, you may find here and there certainly a way where you feel, oh, I think it would have been clearer if Max had written so and so and so. And if you feel that, be happy about it. Don't think that I am disturbed about it or that I feel attacked about it. I know that because over these 30 years, whenever I had an opportunity, say in a summer school or in a class, to take up a chapter, I would polish these epitomes every time. They were polished many times until they are like this here. They started out 30 years ago, and then I polished them, and I polished them. And if I would do it perhaps next year or so, and would say, well, let's go over it again, I may here and there change something. But the interesting thing is, which amazes me always, is this. I told you that it was about 30 years ago that I opened up the textbook with the tones, with these epitomes. And in those 30 years, I don't think I had to change one passage. Passage would mean the rendering, the wording of it. I didn't have to change one break. The structure. It was right. It's still the same. I have here old notes in here that are from 1956. They're still good. They're still absolutely right. And that has always somehow puzzled me. Puzzled in a nice sense. That it is possible that once you have the tonality, that one can be so definite and so sure about interpreting the text just as it would be a mathematical textbook. And you do the exercise in mathematics. naturally, I also have to say that as being used to think as a scientist, as much as I could, every scientist, when he finds out something new, he takes into confidence some of his colleagues and says, could you look that over? Could you see if that is all right? Do you agree with it? Do you come actually to the same conclusions? And I did that. I did it with one person, a good student of John Dolly, Betty Schurter. I don't know, you don't know her, but you know her from the compendium. And I remembered that long, long chapter on Footsteps of Truth, which is a terrific long chapter. And the longer a chapter is, the more difficult it is to find the structure, because sometimes a tone or a subtone will go over pages and pages. And second, I found that that chapter has two parts without that Mrs. Eddy says it has two parts, or would textually or in printing bring out that there are part one or part two. But I felt very distinctly that there are two absolutely different parts, part one and part two. And part one, I found, was laid out in the 7x7. That's 49. And part two was laid out by the 7x7. That's another 49. And 49 plus 49 is still about 98. There were 98 subtones. And so I said to Betty Schurter, I said, you take that chapter, please, and see what kind of a layout you find. And I didn't give her the slightest indication what I found. Not the slightest. Or else I would have given a preconception, huh? Preconceived. And so she said, oh yes, I like to do it. So she went away, and after some time, I don't know anymore if it was after a week or weeks, that doesn't matter. And there were only one point where we differed. Just slightly, you know, by a little paragraph or so. And it's not always quite clear if one should one paragraph in or if that is a bridge from the preceding one to the next one. But that showed that if one has a cultured sense of things, that actually it should be easy for each student to read the textbook and find the same layout. Yeah, that's the point in it. So we have, oh yes, I sidetracked to this point because I said, well, naturally the rendering and the wording of it, that's something which must remain rather flexible. Yes, so that the rendering naturally must be flexible and you must remain flexible, but the tonality must be right. So finally we come to the last one. That's a longish one, but very simple. We come to soul as love. Audible prayer is impressive. And with impressive, one gets at once a sense this has to do with soul, with a kind of sentiment and ecstasy and so on, if something is impressive. And actually she goes on and says, it gives momentary solemnity. That's why it's so impressive. When we have momentary solemnity, we know this is the counterfeit really of soul, of the joy of soul, the satisfaction of soul, and elevation of thought. One just can begin to see the ecstatic sense of soul, which is actually material sense and not soul. But does it produce any lasting benefit? That's a very good one. Is it really, you know, and people go in ecstasy or over their vision and all highfalutin about it, does it have any lasting benefit? It usually doesn't have any lasting benefit, no benefit at all usually. Benefit is love, huh? Has no benefit. Looking deeply into these things, we find that a zeal not according to knowledge, again, a false sense of the balance of soul, of the inner joy of soul, that balance is out of balance. It's a zeal not according to knowledge. Gives occasion for reaction unfavorable to spiritual growth, sober resolve, and wholesome perception of God's requirement. So it depicts really that audible prayer that goes into ecstasy over one's vision. The motives for verbal prayer may embrace too much love of applause. You can see again that ecstatic prayer. To induce or encourage Christian sentiment. You have that wonderful comparison. First, all along those lines from line 8 down to line 15, 16, the counterfeit really of Christian sentiment, of that real true soul sense, which is joyous, which is happy, which is satisfactory, which is supreme, but is balanced. Whereas the wrong prayer gets out of balance. It's a zeal not according to knowledge. It's overdoing things in every way. It's a momentary solemnity and elevation of thought, but only momentary, has no balance in it. So we find here that only a balanced sense of prayer, of soul, has a real benefit in it, love, a real reward in it. And that true balance she calls Christian sentiment. Again, she takes it up and defines it now even clearer and goes much more to the bottom of everything and says, well, it's physical sensation, not soul, which produces material ecstasy and emotion. See, first in the paragraph above, she described that emotional sense of prayer, that false solemnity, really, of prayer. That see not according to knowledge. And now she said, what is that really? That's not soul. That is actually physical sensation. That produces material ecstasy and emotion. She really debunks really that false sense of solemnity. We know from experience that in most of the churches or of the cults and so on, they really go into emotion and think that is glorifying the Lord Jesus and so on. Anyway, when I look at the TV over here and see on a Sunday those preachers, God, isn't that... Then you get all that ecstasy and emotion, and people think this is very near to God Almighty, though they come with a background, And then we must see that that is actually physical sense, material ecstasy. So she says, if spiritual sense, now you get the true sense, if spiritual sense always guided men, there would grow out of ecstatic moments a higher experience, and a better life, with more, what? Devout self-abnegation. Can you hear self-abnegation, the rule of soul? Self-abnegation is the rule of soul. And so, but is a devout self-abnegation, therefore has a touch of love. A self-satisfied ventilation. Now you get it again, huh? A false sense of soul. A real ventilation of fervent sentiments never makes a Christian. Again describes here that is not Christian sentiment, the way she depicted it on line 16. So, again, the opposite of Christian sentiment is that servant, that self-satisfied ventilation that never makes a Christian. God is not influenced by men. Why does she say that? She says because people think the more they go into ecstasy, the more God will hear them, the more God will answer them. And so she had to say, but God is not influenced by men, not influenced by ecstasy and emotion. Then comes a very interesting point. The divine ear. Why does she suddenly talk about divine ear? Because God is not influenced by men, would say God does not hear these ecstatic prayers. Does not hear. He doesn't have an ear to hear that. Cannot be influenced. So she has now to give the positive sense of that hearing. So the divine ear is not an auditory nerve. What is it? It is the all-hearing and all-knowing mind. Suddenly she goes back to mind, as if she would leave now the tone of soul. To whom each need of man is always known, and by whom it will be supplied. Do you hear what it is? Huh? A second scriptural note. Huh? Your Father knows. That Father has a divine ear, and it's the all-hearing and all-knowing mind who supplies everything, to whom each need of man is always known, and by whom it will be supplied. So, if one would not know really those categories, those levels that are involved in the text, one would feel that she drops here the subject and suddenly goes back to love and mind, or mind and love. And we say, yes, that's wonderful. She must do that from time to time and show that it's actually a higher level that is here addressed. Namely, can you say addressed that is here under question? Love and mind, but as soul. Love and mind. Love, of which he said that it that always by to whom each need of man is known and by whom it will be supplied. That's typically love, supply, and known, mind, your Father knows. But it's all directed towards soul. Namely, towards the true ear, the divine ear, towards the divine sense. Because hearing, seeing, touching, and so on are considered to be senses of, material sense, physical sense, And so instead of physical sense, she must also give a soul sense about it, and so translate it to that ear that is soul. So actually, she shows here love and mind at the point of soul, at the point of hearing. What testimony does love and mind take in? Takes in the testimony of soul, and that testimony of soul is the fact against the opposite, namely solemnity, ecstasy, elevation of thought, etc., etc. Do you also get a feel of the exactness of language in the textbook? That it isn't so that one feels, oh well, Mrs. Eddy had to use nice words and nice renderings and write a nice style or into nice prose, and perhaps put a little bit poetic sense into that prose and so on, just to make it nicely readable and so on. Thus you begin to interpret the text now, you feel this is really spiritual mathematics, as she said on page 2. It's really a calculation with ideas, calculation with qualities, and with the counterfeit of these qualities, but it's an exact calculation. Once she has put the proposition, namely in those two scriptural notes, then she sticks to that proposition and unfolds the whole proposition of prayer always along those two great pillars. And not just whatever comes into her mind. So, our epitome here is the prayer of spiritual sense and of the perception of God's requirements makes us a Christian. That Christian sentiment must be brought out. See, see these epitomes which we had up to now, they never really took in the higher tone of love and mind. We excluded them always, because the melody, the tune is only on the 7x7. Just as if we hear a tune that is played by a whole orchestra, we take in the tune is, so to say, a linear development. Because if we take in the tune, we can hum that tune. Say, if a band plays My Fair Lady or anything like that, a song of My Fair Lady, what can we do? You see, this is the most interesting thing, really. And that's always fascinated me, because I don't know anything about music. But it's always fascinated me that a whole band can play, say, one of these songs, you know, with various instruments. And every instrument plays something else. But when you reproduce that with one voice, if you want to whistle it or sing it or hum it, we can only hum it in one voice. We are not trained to sing in two and three voices. And therefore, there is somewhere an ability within us to reduce that multiplicity, that multidimensional music, down to one dimensional melody. I can hum it, and everybody can recognize it, and say, oh yes, you know, that's from Fair Lady. Isn't it interesting? You have a multidimensional presentation in music, and you can reduce it to the core of that whole thing, namely to the melody. unmistakably, the moment we would take in that melody something that is not fundamental, that perhaps belongs to the harp or to the flute or something, we would get out of rhythm, we would get out of tune. Am I explaining it? Is it right? So, those who know music, you see, for me this is a marvel. I don't know why this is so. I can hear that the violin plays something else, and I don't know what plays something else. And out of that, you reduce the melody, and you can reproduce it in one voice. That's the same here. We take that whole text, but when we epitomize it, we don't take in all the vertical instruments, the vertical tones. We leave them out, and we can leave them out without destroying the melody. If we just go right back to the one-dimensional linear development of a one-voice melody. So, in this epitome here, which we just read about, soul and love, we left out all that which has to do with love and mind, with the all-hearing mind that will supply everything, because that is not the melody in it. That's the supporting foundation, you see, that makes it bigger, but does not deviate from the melody. So you can stay with your epitomes, you should actually just stay with the main theme. Gosh, that was difficult, huh? No, it's easy. Huh? We break it right down, it's easy. Spiritual things really are easy, because they are simple. The human mind makes it very complicated. See, always when people say, well, this subject is very complicated, I always think, yes, you are complicated. Because I don't see anything complicated. We learn in school all sorts of things that are 100 times more complicated. Here we learn just one thing which says, you know, all what you have to know are 15 things. The 7 and the 4 and the 4. And 15 is not really very much. One has to learn much more in school than 15 things. And here we have only to learn 15 things. And then we have it, and we have reduced the whole to simplicity. But the human mind is trained in a false system of reference, and therefore has a false calculus. And to get the human mind to the point where it gives up the false calculus, that's a hell of a job. That's really a hell of a job. But if one is willing to let go, to be just blank, you know. Always, every day, just say, I'm blank. I have no preconceptions. So what do I know if I go out from the one principle? And you established your 7 and your 4 and your 4, and that's simple, and that's all. All right, tomorrow we go on.